Well, as I say, I'm going to talk today, go on with this discussion of the unconscious, pointing out that it can, in all circumstances, work either to our advantage or to our disadvantage, that the unconscious is both negative and positive, both creative and destructive. In the orthodox Freudian theory, there is much more concern with what may be called the negative side of the unconscious than with the positive. This, I think, was inevitable, seeing that the theory was developed in a therapeutic context, that Freud, after all, was working with neurotic people in the Vienna of the late 19th century, and he was primarily preoccupied with these negative aspects of the unconscious. In this respect, in the respect of dealing with the positive side of the unconscious, I would say that the work of the pioneer psychologist F.W.H. Myers is much more illuminating than the work of Freud. Myers was about 15 years older than Freud, but died about 40 years before he did. And his great work, which was published posthumously in 1902, still remains, after nearly 60 years, a mine of information, a great source book on the subject, above all, of the creative and positive side of the unconscious. And this is a book which I recommend very strongly to anybody who wants to know about the positive aspects of what Freud dealt with on the negative side. Quite recently, a paperback volume has come out of by Freud, called by the editor Creativity and the Unconscious, and it's a collection of Freud's papers. But when one looks into the papers, one finds there is really remarkably little on this subject of creativity, so that even in these, when he was discussing the positive side, he has really very little contribution to make. And as I say, we must go elsewhere if we want to talk about the positive side. Well, let us begin now with the negative unconscious. And let us begin with the idiomatic phrases which we constantly use. Language contains a great deal of fossil wisdom, and many idiomatic phrases throw a great deal of light on the insight of the ages into the problems of man. After all, we use phrases, for example, "I don't know what came over me." "I must have been mad." "I must have been out of my mind." "Can't have been himself when he did that." "I don't know what possessed me." We use all these phrases, and of course in the last phrase we come straight back to the idea of demonic possession, which we found in Homer and in the Bible. And it is very significant that we find in these idiomatic phrases this very clear picture of an ego surrounded by irrational forces which are continually breaking in upon it and compelling it to do all sorts of things that it really doesn't want to do. Now let us begin with something we talked about in the previous lecture, the unconscious as a manifestation of events in the body, the unconscious as the representation in the mind of certain physical anomalies. We find, for example, that one type of negative unconscious influence is due to congenital physical defect of one kind or another. We have, for example, the physical defect of extremely low IQ, or the physical effect of some kind of malformation which leads on the unconscious level to terrible feelings of inferiority which have to be overcompensated and so on. We have defects in the form of anomalies in the endocrine system which lead to all kinds of very strange psychological results, which are felt as barriers and hindrances and compulsions on the unconscious level, things which interfere with the conscious self's doing what it wants to do. This is one of the physical effects. Then the unconscious effects of physical events. Then we have to consider the unconscious effects of quite normal physical events. We have to consider what happens to people who find themselves born with a certain kind of temperament, but are living in a society where that temperament is undervalued or even regarded as abnormal or disreputable. In this context, it's worth quoting a little poem by William Blake, a very touching little poem, where he says, "Oh, why was I born with a different face? Why was I not born like the rest of my race? When I look, each one stares. When I talk, I offend. Then I'm silent and passive and lose every friend. Then my verse I dishonor, my pictures despise, my person degrade and my temper chastise. And my pen is my terror, my pencil my shame, and my talents I bury, and dead is my fame." This is a very vivid picture of what happens to a person of one kind of temperament who finds himself living, as I've said, in a society in which that kind of temperament is greatly undervalued and where other kinds of temperament are regarded as the only normal and reputable ones. This, of course, is the predicament in which an extremely introverted cerebrotonic child finds himself in an actively progressive school where he is being compelled to be a good mixer and to be constantly with other people and to join in the fun, etc., etc. All things which he finds completely opposed to his deepest ingrained nature, with the result, of course, that all kinds of disturbances go on in his unconscious, and he very often develops a neurosis. Freud himself was in part responsible for this kind of somatotonic revolution, as it may be called, this idea that only the outgoing self is normal. He says in so many words that the extroverted way of life is the way of health for every man. Well, Freud himself was an extrovert of a rather aggressive type, and undoubtedly that way of life was the way of health for him. But it seems to me perfectly obvious from observation that this is not the way of health for many people, and that any attempt to force these people into adopting this way of life against their ingrained and congenital tendencies is bound to have the most disturbing effects upon the unconscious and, of course, to result in some kind of neurosis. Next among the influences from the physique which affect us is the influences of are the influences of sickness, particularly of chronic sickness, and much of this chronic sickness is, of course, of psychosomatic origin, and we see this distressing process going on where the conscious ego and the personal unconscious starts interfering with what Aristotle used to call the vegetative soul, the wisdom of the body. The body then goes wrong. Because it goes wrong, the normal processes of psychology are thrown out. The ego feels itself more than ever frustrated. And the in turn affects, interferes with the normal functioning of the body still further, so that the whole process goes round and round in a terrible vicious circle, a kind of mutual deterioration society of the mind and body making each other constantly worse and worse. And in these various contexts, I think it's worth pointing out that human misery, which has after all been greatly stressed by all the founders of the world religions, the Christian religion insists that this is a veil of tears, the Buddha says, I show you sorrow, meaning the world which we find around us, and also I show you the ending of sorrow, which is the road to enlightenment. When we consider the problem of human misery, I think we should be justified in saying that probably about one third of human misery is inevitable, is due to the fact that we are sentient beings in a largely insentient universe which is not concerned with our well-being. But about two thirds of our misery is strictly homemade and is the product of ignorance, stupidity, and to a less frequent extent, of malice. Well, the moral of that, as the Duchess in Alice would say, is get rid of stupidity and ignorance, which naturally is a great deal easier said than done. Well, now we have to consider that aspect of the negative unconscious, which is specifically, has been specifically the concern of the psychoanalysts, and which is obviously an extremely important part of the whole picture. This is the side of the unconscious represented by repression. Freud himself has said, we obtain our theory of the unconscious from the theory of repression. This area of the unconscious is simply due to repression, according to Freud, and I think he is perfectly right. What happens is very clear, that we have, in childhood above all, we have certain urges and wishes and purposes which do not conform with the cultural standards around us, and which we soon learn to regard as highly discreditable, and which we therefore repress, which we push down into an area of the mind where we are no longer aware of them. We are no longer aware of them, but needless to say, they continue to exist, and they exercise a very great and very pernicious influence upon our thoughts and feelings and actions on the conscious level. And it's not, of course, only the discreditable wishes and urges and purposes that we repress. We also repress incidents which are too painful for us to think about. We just can't take the thought of certain things which have happened to us, and consequently, we push them down out of sight. The most vulnerable age, of course, is the age during which cultural pressure weighs upon us most heavily, is infancy and childhood. And it is, of course, during infancy and childhood that most of the work of repression goes on. And this buried material is formed at that time. And in neurosis, we are, in fact, suffering the penalty of things which we did and things which happened to us many years ago in extreme youth. Then, of course, along with repression from the inside, repression by the ego in the name of cultural ideals and of duty and religion and so on, along with repression, there goes conditioning from outside. And this, I think, is of equal importance in the history of the negative unconscious. Conditioning, of course, can take place in almost any condition of the subject. But as Pavlov has shown, conditioning is most effective when the subject is under great physical or mental stress, when the subject is in pain or is suffering from fear or is in the throes of some violent emotion, anger, even joy may be the case, he is peculiarly susceptible to conditioning. And it is in these times of lowered resistance that conditioned reflexes are set up most easily and are most permanent. It was Pavlov found it exceedingly difficult to get rid of the conditioning which had been imposed upon dogs under a great state of stress. And of course, precisely these Pavlovian techniques have been used in brainwashing, so-called, both on enemies and on friends, because the brainwashing is probably much more intensive on communist workers in China than it was even on the prisoners during the Korean War. And as I say, this whole procedure of pushing in ineradicable conditioning is based on the work which Pavlov did in the early years of this century upon dogs. And it is quite clear, of course, that some conditioning is absolutely essential and very good. But it's equally clear that there are plenty of conditioning is extremely undesirable and may lead in later life to very severe troubles. So that we see that our great part of our negative unconscious is due first to repression, the influence of these buried urges and desires and pains which the ego has taken care to shove away out of sight, and also to the undesirable conditioning which has been put into us at an earlier period, often under a condition of stress, and which continues to act upon us very much as a post-hypnotic suggestion continues to act upon a person after he's emerged from trance. And neurosis, then, is the failure of the conscious ego to deal with the events of the moment in appropriate terms, in terms appropriate to the moment. Instead of dealing with what is happening now in terms of what a realistic appraisal of what is happening now would dictate, the neurotic person deals with these events in terms of feelings and hidden memories, which he doesn't know about consciously, of events which took place long ago, feelings which are totally irrelevant to what is happening at the present time. And in a certain sense, it may be said that all psychotherapy is essentially a kind of spring cleaning of the memory. We have to clean up the memory to get rid of the aspects of the aspects of memory which are making us behave in this totally irrelevant way. It is not, of course, a question of getting rid of remembered facts. We have to go on remembering the multiplication table and geography lessons and so on. It is a question of getting rid of, ridding the memory of these painful emotional states which cause us to act in a completely inappropriate way in the present time, that we are reacting not to now, we are reacting to then. Consequently, everything we do is completely pointless and senseless. It has, of course, been realized for a very long time that the memory in its unregenerate form is a very dangerous faculty, which can put us very wrong. We find very interesting passages about this in Buddhist literature. And I was interested not long ago to find a very interesting passage in the writings of St. John of the Cross, the great Spanish mystical writer of the 16th century, on the problem of memory. This is what he says. He says, the emptying of the memory, though its advantages are not so great as those of the state of union with God, yet merely because it delivers souls from much sorrow, grief, and sadness, besides imperfections and sins, is a great good. We may perhaps doubt whether the rather mechanical methods of emptying the memory employed in Catholic monasteries, for example, are likely to be very effective. But nevertheless, it's quite clear that these people were entirely on the right track, and that no doubt that a really effective therapy would make use of some of the methods used in religion, combined with the various methods of analysis and abreactive therapy, which can serve to cleanse the memory under modern conditions. Well, so much for the negative side of the unconscious, the side which is negative side due to physical influences, and the negative side due to repression and to conditioning from the outside. And now let us come to what is equally important, and indeed what I would think was really much more important, the positive side of the unconscious. Here again, let's start with the colloquial phrases which indicate the nature of the positive contribution which the unconscious makes to our life. We use such phrases as, it has suddenly struck me, it has suddenly occurred to me, I have had a brilliant idea, a wonderful notion has come into my head, or the violinist gave an inspired performance, or the preacher spoke as though he were inspired. Here again, we are back with the old Homeric and biblical idea of a supernatural possession, this time a good possession and not a demonic possession. If you remember, Homer speaks about menos, this supernatural access of power which suddenly comes into people. And he also makes an appeal to the muses to help him, and speaks about minstrels who sing out of the gods. It's a very remarkable phrase. Later on, of course, in Greek history, we get the accounts of the Pythia at Delphi, the woman who received the oracles of Apollo, who was in what we should call a medium, and who was in a state of enthusiasm, or the adjective from which is entheos, meaning having the god inside her. So that it's interesting to see when we use these words like inspired, which we do without any particular thought, that we are carrying on a very ancient tradition. And similarly, we find the Bible is full of these same ideas. St. Paul, for example, in the Epistle to the Hebrews, says, God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spoke in time past unto the fathers by the prophets. And when one looks at the works of the prophets themselves, one finds that they think of themselves as passive instruments, and very often as reluctant instruments. They're not particularly anxious to undergo this tremendous influx of some non-rational, much greater power within themselves, but they have to undergo it. And later on, in early Christian times, we have the accounts of the passive involuntary reception by the early Christians of what were called charismata, of these gifts of the Spirit, which came involuntarily into these people. And as we see, until one has a good working hypothesis of the unconscious, both on the negative and the positive side, one is almost forced by the facts to make this appeal to supernatural possession, either by good forces or by evil forces. There is nothing stupidly superstitious about these ideas. There was really no other way of explaining the facts, so long as our kind of hypothesis didn't exist. Now let us consider the positive unconscious in its relation to everyday life. I've already cited these casual idiomatic phrases which we use all the time. And now let us try to analyze to what extent this creative unconscious helps us in our ordinary life. When we look carefully into our everyday experience, we do find, as a matter of fact, that the conscious eye seldom comes up with a really brilliant idea. It's a kind of plodding faculty, that we constantly get this impression that our best ideas come to us from somewhere else, from outside, from an area of our mind which is not our conscious mind. These phrases like, it occurred to me, are really good representations of a fact of everyday experience. I suppose the mechanism of the unconscious must be looked at more or less in these terms, that we consciously take in material which then is passed on to some layer of the unconscious. Freud speaks of this layer as the preconscious, but I would think there are deeper layers beyond the repressed unconscious where this thing goes. We'll have to come to this later. Anyhow, what we take in consciously and think about consciously is then transmitted to this layer of the unconscious, where it undergoes a process of digestion and of organization, and is then represented to the conscious mind in the form of some idea which is often felt to be extremely brilliant and illuminating, an idea which the conscious mind could not of itself have concocted. This notion of a thing from the outside coming in is a regular phenomenon of everyday life. But of course, as it's such an everyday phenomenon, we tend to take it for granted and don't think too much about it. However, we are very decidedly struck and amazed by the more unusual phenomena of the same kind. For example, we are still very much struck by the phenomena of artistic inspiration. This question of artistic inspiration is a very, very ancient idea. We've already noted it in Homer, and in much more primitive peoples is it found. It's a significant fact that in several of the Indo-European languages, the word for poet and the word for seer are the same. We have, for example, in Latin, the word vates, which means both seer and poet, and the same thing is true of the Irish word fili, and the Icelandic word thalr. These all mean seer and poet, the whole idea being that the poet does receive inspiration, that he gets things from some other area than the merely self-conscious mind. And it's worth remarking that many great poets in modern times have felt exactly the same as Homer did, or as even much more primitive people than Homer did. Goethe, for example, says, the songs made me, not I the songs. And the French poet Lamartine says, it is not I who think, it is my ideas that think for me. And Musset says, one doesn't really work, one listens. It is as though some stranger were whispering in one's ear. And Shelley has a very curious and interesting remark on the mind in creation. He says, it is like a fading coal, which some invisible influence, like an evanescent wind, awakens to transitory brightness. And there's a very striking phrase which sums up this whole idea. In the writings of this curious romantic German philosopher von Baader, who says that Descartes was entirely wrong in saying, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, that what he ought to have said was cogitor ergo sum, I am thought, therefore I am. And of course this is, in a certain sense, perfectly true. Insofar as I am a conscious ego, I think, therefore I am. But insofar as I am a creative unconscious, and insofar as my conscious ego requires the work of the collaboration of the creative unconscious, I am thought, and therefore I am, on a more important and better scale than I would have been if I were merely a conscious ego which did my own private thinking being strictly limited. What may be called genius, I suppose, is the uprush of helpful material from the deep levels of the unconscious, of a helpful kind, which is then worked up by the conscious self into appropriate forms. Carlyle, I think it was, said that genius is 9/10 perspiration and only 1/10 inspiration. But there has to be the inspiration first and then the work on it afterwards. And genius is, I suppose, the harmonious collaboration of the two parts of our being, the openness to what lies below us on the unconscious level, the acceptance of what comes up, and then the capacity to mold this material into forms which shall communicate to other people and shall carry over some of the meanings and feelings which the original artist had. But of course, we mustn't imagine that all such uprushes are of the highest quality. There can be uprushes, unfortunately, from the unconscious of all kinds of silliness and stupidity. A painful example of this is the case of Voltaire, who prided himself, above all, on being a poet, a tragic poet. Unfortunately, he was a very bad tragic poet. There's an extraordinary letter where he describes the writing of his tragedy Catiline, which is in 5 acts in rhymed Alexandrines, and which he completed in a week. And he writes to his correspondent saying, nobody who has not felt the afflatus of genius can imagine how such a feat is possible, but I assure you that it is true. Well, it no doubt was true, but unfortunately the play is perfectly unreadable. So that we see that we can have works of art whose creation followed the mode of genius, but the mode of genius in this particular case did not produce the results of genius, so that we can have a kind of pseudo-genius. We can have, yes, we can have real inspiration, but inspiration of a very poor kind. Of course, the most non-genius type of inspiration of this kind is shown by those people who have a gift of automatic writing, who sit down with a pen and these scripts come pouring out. Well, the vast majority of these scripts are completely uninteresting and nonsensical, but they do come up from the depths in the same kind of way that the inspirations of genius come to men of genius. The difference being that in the case of men of genius, what comes up is originally of much better quality, and the work which then they put into it in their conscious state of mind brings the final creation to a pitch where it can be appreciated by other people and felt to be of great significance and importance. A particularly odd kind of creative unconscious intervention is illustrated by the cases of the so-called calculating boys. These are very odd phenomena. They keep on recurring. Every now and then we read in the papers the story of a child who can perform the most astounding mental calculations in his head, can find the cube root of seven-figure numbers in 50 seconds and things like this. And let me read a case, which is a charming one, the case of an English calculating boy called Blythe, who was born in 1819. And this is a story which his brother tells of him, that the little boy Benjamin and his father were going for a walk before breakfast. The father liked taking a brisk walk before breakfast. And suddenly the little boy asked, "Papa, at what hour was I born?" And the father said, "At 4 a.m. What o'clock is it now?" 7:50. The boy walked on for about 100 yards in silence and then gave the number of seconds that he had lived. He was then 6 years old, roughly, more or less. The father didn't attempt to check the figure at the time, but when he got home, he sat down with pencil and paper, worked it all out, and came with some triumph to the child and said, "I regret to say you are 172,800 seconds out." The boy said, "Oh, Papa, you have left out the 2 days for the leap years of 1820 and 1824. Complete collapse of Papa. Well, these are really perfectly extraordinary cases. I mean, why on earth do certain children have this fantastic power? And what sort of a mind do we have that is capable of this sort of thing? The history of calculating boys is very curious. In recent centuries, there have been two calculating boys who grew up to be men of the first-rate genius, Ampère in France and Gauss in Germany. Both had this extraordinary gift as children. There have been several other cases where they grew up to be very capable mathematicians and intelligent men. But there have also been many cases where they grew up to be either completely mediocre or else even virtually half-witted. The oddest of all these cases is of a German called Dase, who lived in the middle of the 19th century. He was incapable of understanding the first book of Euclid, but he had such an incredible faculty for doing sums in his head that he was paid a lifetime salary by the Prussian government for finding the factors of all numbers between 7 millions and 8 millions. And he spent his life doing this, and with an incredible rapidity. I mean, the sort of work which would have been now, I suppose, done by electronic machines. But he produced these tables, which are perfectly correct, without, as I say, ever having been able to understand the first book of Euclid. He had absolutely no powers of ratiocination at all. And yet he was able to do these extraordinary sums. So that here we see a particularly strange case of work of the creative unconscious. Well, now let us briefly speak about another aspect, which is that of sleep. I mentioned this in my first lecture, and I think we must repeat again that the only reason why we are as well and as sane as we are is because the ego takes a holiday for one-third of every day, that if we remained awake all the time, we should undoubtedly all be extremely ill and all quite mad. And while the ego is out of the way during sleep, we may say that the creative unconscious is, I suppose, what is called the vegetative soul, the wisdom of the body, functioning without interference from this intolerable self and its and the personal unconscious, and keeping us well and sane. But there is, of course, another activity during sleep, which is dreaming, again, a very peculiar activity. Most dreams naturally refer to recent events, to events which took place during the day before we went to sleep, and or in very recent times. But some, quite clearly, as the Freudians have pointed out, refer in a symbolic way to buried material. And yet others seem to partake of the nature of what Jung calls great dreams, and to refer to what he calls archetypal material on a far lower level of the unconscious. And some don't seem even to refer to that. They refer to something which doesn't seem to have any particular relation to the human psyche. And these final dreams, these archetypal and these completely out of other world dreams, bring us to another very strange phenomenon of the unconscious, the phenomenon of visions. Visions, of course, can occur spontaneously. Many children, I'm quite sure, have such visions, and probably the gift goes on in the life of many adults. Of course, in our world at the present time, such people keep their mouths shut about these things, because they would immediately be thought mad if they confessed to having such visions. But of course, in another climate of opinion, such people would have been thought very highly of, and they would have been listened to when they described their visions. But as I say, these spontaneous visions seem to be fairly common. Blake had them all the time, and we have some very curious accounts of the nature of his visions. He's left an account, for example, of how he came to make a drawings of Sir William Wallace, the Scotch hero, and of Edward I. He says, "I was sitting meditating, as I had often done, on the heroic actions of the Scottish hero, Sir William Wallace, when, like a flash of lightning, a noble form stood before me, which I instinctively recognized as Wallace. Knowing that it was a spiritual appearance, which might vanish as quickly as it had come, I begged him to remain for a few minutes. The hero smiled, and I sketched him. Presently the phantom vanished, and Edward I, who also remained long enough to be sketched, took his place." Then there is a very interesting account by John Varley of his drawing of the famous head of the ghost of a flea. Blake drew this in Varley's house. And Varley has left this description: "I felt convinced by his manner of proceeding that he had a real image before him. For at one point, he left off and began to make a separate drawing on another part of the paper of the mouth of the flea, which the spirit having opened, he was prevented from proceeding with in the first sketch until the mouth had been closed again." Well, this is a very curious account. I mean, he was looking at something which wasn't there, he was drawing it with its closed mouth. It then opened its mouth. He then had to make another drawing of the open mouth and wait till the thing had closed it again. What sort of a mind is it that we have that can produce this kind of thing? And of course, there have been other very celebrated visionaries. I mean, we have the most curious case of the 18th century Swedish scientist and man of affairs, Swedenborg, who had these extremely interesting visions of life in the next world, of an enormous elaboration and detail, which must have come to him with complete sense of reality. And then there is, within the tradition of the church, there is the whole series of visionaries, beginning with St. Bridget of Sweden in the 13th century, who had visions of the passion of Christ, in the most elaborate detail. The last, and perhaps the most elaborate of them, is Catherine Emmerich, who died in the beginning of the 19th century. And these visions do not correspond with one another, and it is therefore impossible to say whether any of them are in fact veridical post-cognitive visions. I think we probably have to put them down, in most cases, to what may be called the storytelling faculty, which lies at the back of the mind. This, I think, is a very peculiar faculty. It seems to be present to a certain extent in all minds and can be evoked by various methods, which we will describe later. But in certain cases, occurs spontaneously. The most famous of these cases is that of Robert Louis Stevenson, who describes in a chapter of Across the Plains how he got the material for all his stories. He either saw them in a reverie or dreamed them during sleep. And he says they were provided for him by these people inside his mind who were not his conscious self and whom he called the brownies. And he said the brownies used to, when he was a boy, used to produce their material in a rather haphazard way, but when he had to make his living as a writer, they collaborated with him and would produce good saleable material, which he then would wake up or come out of reverie and start writing down. And all these, his admirable stories, were provided for him by this strange storytelling side of the brain. And here it's worthwhile mentioning that when Homer and the poets who followed him asked for inspiration from the Muses, they were not asking for poetical skill. They were asking for material. They were saying, please tell me what really happened at the siege of Troy, or what really happened during these myths, mythical histories. Hesiod, for example, is delighted when the muse provides him with some new names which he can bring in. So that they were making the appeal, evidently, above all, to this storytelling faculty at the back of our minds. As for the execution, the actual stylistic execution, this they knew well enough and which they could do with their conscious minds. But the other thing, the material of the epic and mythological poems, had to be provided for them by the muses. Now, so much for the visions which occur spontaneously. Then, of course, there have been, in the course of history, many methods for inducing visions. Most religions have thought it very valuable to produce visions, and going beyond visions to produce pre-mystic or fully mystical states, and have adopted various methods for facilitating the production of visions. Many of these methods, of course, are concerned with changing the blood chemistry in such a way that it shall open up this area of the mind. I mean, you get these classical methods of changing body chemistry by fasting, for example, by waking, by insomnia, by self-punishment, which of course produces a great deal of histamine and adrenaline. Then there are other more purely psychological methods. Oh, I should have mentioned also the methods of breathing exercises, which are all supposed to lead up to suspensions of breath, which naturally increase the volume of CO2 in the blood, which, as we know, has a profound effect upon the psychological state and is actually used now by certain therapists in producing visionary and buried material. Then, of course, there are the techniques like concentration purely, or else, on the other hand, alert passivity, letting go, both of which may help to produce visions and the states beyond vision. And then there is the cultivation of extreme solitude, the reduction of the number of external stimuli, which again, if the solitude goes on for long enough and the stimuli are sufficiently reduced, produce very remarkable visions. Well, long experiments have been made in this field by Hebb at McGill and by Lilly at the National Institute of Health in Washington, in what they call limited environment. And it is a most extraordinary thing that when the environment is exceedingly limited by the methods used by Lilly, where there's no hearing, no seeing, virtually no touch, because you're submerged in a warm bath at body temperature, within 2 or 3 hours, the most extraordinary visions start taking place. And the interesting thing is that in the great majority of cases, these visions are exceedingly unpleasant. And here one is reminded very much of the historical material where, for example, the monks in the Thebaid, like St. Anthony, almost invariably had diabolic visions as a result of their prolonged solitude. St. Anthony had many more diabolic visions, as we see from these innumerable pictures of the temptations of St. Anthony in every art gallery of the world. But he did have, going to his being a well-trained and deeply religious man, have a certain number of positive visions too. But anyhow, these are methods of inducing visions, and it is a very remarkable fact that the moment our minds are cut off from external stimuli, they start working by themselves, producing material, much of which is exceedingly frightening, but some of which can be very enlightening and rewarding. Much of the material is so very frightening that Hebb, who paid $20 a day to students to volunteer, found he could get no more volunteers. And students who won't do something for $20 must have a very bad time indeed. And then, of course, there are other methods of inducing visions. I mean, there are the various chemical methods which have been used from time immemorial. Alcohol, peyote, banisteria, various kinds of fungus and so on, which have culminated now in the discovery of this extraordinary drug, lysergic acid, which produces the most revolutionary effects upon the mind in doses of 1/10,000th of a gram, and has very little or no bad consequences for the body. So that we see then that there are these ways in which these strange aspects of the mind, some of which are negative, but some of which are most decidedly positive. There are ways in which they can be induced, and so that we don't have to rely in the exploration of this strange other world of the mind. We do not have to rely any longer on the rare cases where they occur spontaneously. We now can investigate the subject artificially without any serious risk to the subjects involved, which I think is a very important fact. We now come to a very ticklish subject, the subject of parapsychology. Now, this, in many academic circles, is regarded as a rather obscene subject and is treated almost as a kind of intellectual pornography. Indeed, I would think there are some academic circles where it would be more respectable to study the works of the Marquis de Sade than the works of Dr. J.B. Ryan. Nevertheless, I do happen to think that such phenomena as telepathy, clairvoyance, and precognition actually occur. I think it's impossible to study the evidence accumulated since 1882, the year of the foundation of the Psychical Research Society in London, the enormous mass of evidence accumulated in the journals and proceedings of the society, and to study the experimental work done in recent years at Duke and other universities, without coming to the conclusion that these phenomena do in fact occur. Now, I won't go into the details of the phenomena because I think everybody knows what they are, but it is necessary to say something about the reasons why so many otherwise open-minded scientific people refuse even to consider the evidence. The reason is quite clear. The reason is that the facts, if they are facts, just don't make sense. They don't make sense in terms of the Weltanschauung, the worldview, which we accept as more or less axiomatic. They don't make sense, above all, in the view that we have of human nature and its relation to the universe around us. And in point of fact, we, most of us, I suppose, are still influenced unconsciously by the hypothesis of Descartes about the nature of man and its relation to the world. Descartes insisted that the world was divided into two halves, one half a matter and the other half mind, and that the man was divided into a mind and a body. The material half of the world he regarded as of one substance, but the mental half was composed of innumerable substances, that every individual mind was a separate, impenetrable unit of a substantial nature. This unit could never react directly with other units, with other minds, and it could react with matter only in relation to the matter of its own body, and of course through the body with other pieces of matter. And also the essence of this mental substance, Descartes insisted, was consciousness. Well, we now know that we've rejected the idea that the essence of the mind is consciousness. But it seems to me now that in the light of modern psychology and of, I would say, of parapsychology, we have to revise the Cartesian assumptions about the nature of the mind. I think we have to insist that the mind has this great unconscious side, this we know now, and but we have to add that the unconscious side at its lowest fringe is not enclosed, that it touches a kind of, so to say, a psychic medium out of which individual minds are crystallized, and through this psychic medium is enabled to establish contact with other minds. And I would say, too, that the Cartesian idea of a pure dualism within man has to be supplemented. We have to think of it, of man as a composite rather of three factors, of a body, what the Western philosophers call a pure ego, and what the Eastern philosophers call an Atman, what St. Paul called a pneuma, and a mind, a psyche, which is not a separate unity, a watertight unity, but is rather a thing composed. And I think that we may have to think of the elementary psychological particles out of which the psyche is composed as being, in the vaguest sense of the word, ideas, that these elementary particles can then be built up into things like complexes, like what the Buddhists call skandhas, and the whole thing bound together in a not very tight, or rather precarious and unstable unity, which we call the self. Its instability, of course, is clearly proved by what happens to it in many cases of mental disorder, and even of what happens in stressful conditions of normal life. So that we have then this picture, which I shall have to, part of which I shall have to discuss in a later lecture, the part related to the pure ego or Atman. I think we'll need much further discussion later on. But meanwhile, we have this picture of a precarious and rather unstable self in relationship to an unconscious, which is not shut in at the lower levels or at the upper levels either, but is open at both ends, and where there can be communications with minds or mind outside itself. This leaves us, of course, in an uncomfortable philosophical position, because, as I say, these facts just don't fit satisfactorily into the generally accepted world picture at the present time. So we have to be content, I think, with this kind of anomaly. The problem has been discussed by two eminent contemporary philosophers, Dr. Broad of Cambridge and Dr. Haberley Price of Oxford, neither of whom can really come up with a satisfactory answer. But a fortiori, I cannot possibly come up with a satisfactory answer. But at the moment, I think we have to accept a kind of ambivalent notion about human nature, that for most practical purposes, we have to think in terms of something like neutral monism, of the mind and body being aspects of the same substance. But we also have to think in the light of what the facts, as I regard them, the facts of parapsychology, we also have to think that, to some extent, mind is independent of body and can exist in a kind of psychic medium, that ideas may have a life of their own and may enter our idea system in a very peculiar and difficult to understand way, and that also ideas may perhaps go on, may persist in existing long after the bodies connected with the minds in which the ideas were originally invented have died. So that there may be a kind of reservoir of this mental life going on, into which, as I say, we plunge. And above this, and enveloping it and interpenetrating with it, I think we may also have to postulate something which William James spoke of as cosmic consciousness, which Bergson spoke of as mind in the capital M, embracing this whole thing. I shall have to talk about this in a later lecture, and at the present, let me leave this subject on this very unsatisfactory note of an unresolved philosophical problem, for the good reason that I don't know how to resolve it, and I don't think at present anybody else knows how to resolve it, but that it will be resolved sooner or later, I feel quite sure. Meanwhile, we have to go on as best we may with this oddly anomalous situation in which we at present find ourselves. Thank you.